on February 4th. We're all in attendance with the exception of Senator Lincoln. So we have before us a couple of measures today. Senate Bill 266, the Bristol Bay Oil and Gas Lease Sale Closure. And notice we have the Director of Division of Oil and Gas, the Mark Myers is in the audience. Mr. Myers, I assume you're presenting the bill. Care to join us?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Now, why the heck do we want to close lease sales? This is kind of counterintuitive. There's a good reason I know. Would you explain that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Mark Myers, Director of Division Oil and Gas. Reason to close the area is we have multiple leasing programs. One is area-wide leasing, which is a competitive program that provides basically grassroots, surface to grassroots oil and gas mineral rights, bid competitively, best interest finding process done in front of it. We have a second program called exploration licensing, which allows, it's competitive in nature, but either an applicant or the state goes out with an area, it allows up to 500,000 acres to be there to a single lessee or a single licensee, which can then bid a work commitment. That work commitment then, once it's completed, the area can be converted to leases. All a part of that 500,000 acres, 10,000 to 500,000 acres can be converted to leases. The third program is shallow gas leasing. It's an over-the-counter program. It's limited depth rights. It's, again, non-competitive. It's first file. It's $5,000 filing. It's designed really for areas where you don't typically have competitive sales or areas that you don't have exploration licenses. In this case, we want to do an oil and gas mineral closing order for the area of the proposed Bristol Bay competitive sale. If you look in the area here on this map, in this area outlined in red, where we see the highest oil and gas potential on the area that will be looked at in the best interest finding for potential oil and gas lease sale. If we weren't to close the mineral entry, the area would either be open for exploration licenses or shallow gas leases. If shallow gas leases were filed through and we issued them, we would take the mineral rights and divide them, split them into parts. We don't think that brings as much value to the lessee. It creates correlative rights problems between the first that problem to get the deeper rights and the shallower rights. And I kind of demonstrate that. This is a geologic cross section. See here, depth of 3,000 feet. So any gas discovered at 3,000 feet, if it was leased with shallow gas leasing, we'd go to that lessee. When the deeper rights were offered to someone else, they'd have the deeper rights. This is not an efficient way to lease. We think we would get more economic value out of the overall competitive license than a competitive sale. So for that order, in order to prepare for the sale, in order to provide maximum value to lessees should the proposed sale go forward, we would like to close this area now to shallow gas leasing and the license proposal. I will say the area of the north, we actually did the opposite. We went out there for, we're not recommending this for mineral closure. It is open to shallow gas leasing now. And we do have an exploration license proposal in this area, which is actually on this map. Bristol Shores, an organization, has proposed a license within that area. So in the area we see for the competitive sale, we don't believe segregating the mineral estate is in the state's best interest, and we'd like to have that full acreage available for the proposed sale in 2005. Commissioner put a temporary mineral closing order in place, but for that to be to withstand, it has to be verified and approved by the legislature.
Okay. All right. So the correlative rights issue, for example, if there was gas that was below 3,000 foot, Mark, that possibly that structure went up into the 3,000 foot level, that's where it gets into the sticky correlative rights. If they could possibly produce the gas that might be associated with a structure that's below the 3,000 feet, somebody else has that lease, and then you have to sit there and prorate it or figure out whose gas is what.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's exactly right. You can stick to the geologic structures. You know, the depth of the shallow gas lease is basically part of the field has to be above 3,000 feet. Some of these geologic structures out here may well do that and continue down the deeper depths, in which case there'd be arguments about whether the deeper lessee owned it or the shallow gas lessee owned it. In general, we're areas where we have shallow gas leases. We tend not to put in license areas for that very reason, because of the correlative rights fight that would ensue. We also, you create an early negotiations between the deep and the shallow lessee, and I think when you, if you had this top file shallow gas lease, you would ultimately get less in the competitive process, competitive bid, because you would have devalued the value of the lease and set up this potential correlative rights issue. So someone could, I guess on the other side, arguably try to block the sale by artificially buying shallow gas leases with no intention of actually developing them, and then therefore significantly decreasing the value of the lease in hope someone doesn't bid. So you can see lots of variations in the theme, but basically keeping the leasehold allows for, like as you suggested, a more cooperative approach in production, better economic way to develop any potential reserves, and a better cost-sharing structure.
Has there been any shallow gas leases applied for in this area?
There have not been, to the best of my knowledge. The closest one are in the Holitna Basin, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. I know when the original legislation was passed, there were some talks of some shallow gas that had been identified from previous drilling onshore in the Bristol Bay area. Are you aware? There are some existing wells in that were drilled, what, back in the 50s, or when was that?
Mr. Chairman, from 1903 through 1985, about 26 wells were drilled in the entire region. Some were drilled outside our proposed lease area, some were in the offshore area, but about a dozen wells were drilled within our area for proposed lease and the license. Those wells, and you can see diagrammatically in this cross section, those wells penetrated into the prospective section. Many of those wells encountered gas. At the time, gas wasn't economic. Some of those wells had fairly good shows of oil. They were never commercially tested, so we don't know the quantity. So we do know both oil and gas are present in the basin, particularly in the southern part of the basin where it's deeper. We know there's significant oil potential. As you move north, the basin thins. We expect dominated by gas potential. We also know the geology is similar to the gas we see in Bougainville, the gas being generated by the coals or biogenically by creatures. So it's a very good overlay to inspect that gas. Much of that gas is shallow. Certainly, coal bed methane has been looked at. There was some test work done, I mean, by DOE and by the state of Alaska, looking at the Chinook Lagoon area, just to see what the coal bed methane potential were. The coals are exposed in outcrop, so we know they're there. Coals themselves are probably the dominant source of the gas, even the conventional gas. Generated the coals and migrated out to the conventional sandstones. So undoubtedly, coal bed methane potential is in the area. We also, when you get a area-wide lease, you're entitled to produce coal bed methane as well as deep gas. So a lessee may look at both. I think they would look at conventional gas first because it's going to probably be more economic, but it doesn't mean there wouldn't be follow-up work for coal bed.
Okay. And I noticed that in the exploration license area up there in the northern part of Bristol Bay, it looks like some of the offshore areas included. Is that intentional, or isn't there a currently moratorium on drilling offshore in Bristol Bay?
Mr. Chairman, that just shows the box the area applied for. Within that, basically, currently, the policy is on the licenses not to include offshore areas. So it would be onshore areas is only, has been the policy. That policy could be changed and it could be allowed. The current standard that we are proposing for a Bristol Bay lease sale would be onshore siting of facilities only. So if license rights or lease rights later are offered in the offshore to the 3-mile limit state waters, they would have to access those potential resources by drilling directionally from onshore. So we're not recommending the siting, or I believe the intention of DNR at this time is to restrict facility placement, other than maybe docks and those sorts of things, but drilling pads, et cetera, to onshore only, which can be directionally drilled offshore.
I've been dominating the questions. See anybody else have any questions? Senator Seekins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I look at the area that you're proposing to be reserved here, the red line is basically out to our 3-mile limit.
Senator Seekins, the chair, that's correct.
So to the extent of our authority, and then goes across the bays up there as designating those as historic bays, and that's how you're coming up with those. Just as a question to clarify in my mind, when we look at those bays, are those already, is that agreed to or is claimed as historic bays underneath that state jurisdiction?
Senator, speaking to the chair, one of the things we have to clarify is the 3-mile limit. It's never been surveyed, for example. Part of what I think you'll see a capital request for us to accelerate that process, but we have to get a defined 3-mile limit. Historical bays, we think, are pretty well established by precedence, but again, that has to be clarified as well. So part of the whole process of putting the lease sale together is to help determine, along with the federal government, where those actual lines are. They're right now lines in a map.
Answers my question. Thank you.
No, I know I've had a briefing on this, Mr. Myers, from your division before session, and I assume maybe some other members in here may have, but maybe you could just, as a background, give us what the plans are for the Bristol Bay area and when you expect the lease offering to be available and what you think the prospect is.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You can see in this chart, these are the proposed timelines for the process if the lease sale is to go forward for a licensed area and then a lease sale. So the targeting time would be followable for the licensed area if it in fact is you, and the followable 5 for the lease sale. Now, this followable 5, as you'll see with the next piece of legislation, is dependent on our ability to notify the legislature at pretty much any time rather than the first part of the session, which is the following bill. If this weren't to be the case, the law wasn't changed, this date would be 2007, because we have to notify you next year and give you 2 years' notice of the upcoming sale. But the process you can see, and we show here, is a long and detailed process which involves the primary document is a best interest finding document. So we go out, in the case of the lease sale, we request information from agencies, we request a lot of public comment. We've done that. We've had multiple meetings out in the Bristol Bay region in particular. We've met with all 3 borough governments. We've met with the Bristol Bay Native Association, the Native Corporation, lots of other folks, interested folks out in the area. And we started that public request for information and public comment. That will eventually lead to what's called a preliminary best interest finding. It's like an EIS document. It's going to list the concerns of that we've heard up to that point. It's going to list the habitat, the sensitive environmental issues, potential stipulations and mitigation measures, the size of the shape, the balancing test between what we think is economic might be economic out there versus the environmental effects, and do that balancing act that's supposed to be done in basically an EIS-type document. That preliminary then will result in going out to the same communities, out to the area, out to a much larger audience for comments. They'll get that document, they'll say, this is what they're proposing, this is what we think of it. We'll have to be responsive and answer every comment, and there'll be that dialogue with the local communities. I will say part of this process is also that's exciting in this particular case is memorandums of understandings we have with Bristol Bay Native Corporation, now the ALU Corporation as well. So working in conjunction with them in terms of customizing the sale and maximize benefits both to the local communities but also to the Native Corporations to the extent that we can. So all that public input and dialogue is going on constantly. We're sharing data with them. But the best interest finding document really becomes the focus of the public feedback and the balancing test the state has to do. So after those initial drafts, we go back out, they comment, we come back with a final determination and then a final decision. So you can see here, the red dots are where there are public informational meetings or public comments. The license is a smaller area you can see up here. It's a little bit faster tracked per the governor's desire to find a local source of energy out there as quickly as we could, followed by the competitive sale. Again, the license areas are somewhat driven by the applicant. The big part of the deal with the license is the work commitment. So it's really a program to assess what potential resources might be out there. It's certainly less prospective, in our opinions, than the competitive sale area. We have a lot more oil potential, and you have a lot more geologic section, and probably a lot better potential trapping mechanisms for both oil and gas. So lots of public process, final best interest finding determination we made, and then the state will determine whether to go ahead with the sale. And then finally, the sale would be held in the case of October,
of 2005, assuming the next legislation passes, and then 2004 fall for the license.
Okay. Is that license up north, is that primarily shallow gas?
The license area, the basin thickness out here is under 5,000 feet. I think you can see maybe on the geologic maps will show the contours. We roughly looked at here the 5,000 foot or mile thickness, thickness. So by definition, everything there is geologically pretty shallow. So the best potential there is for gas, and it's for depths of less than 5,000 feet.
So would that be under the shallow gas rules, though? I mean, so it'd be a non-conventional type air drilled, or do you have any idea yet?
We don't know yet. There certainly would be the opportunity to drill conventional gas plays in the sense of they're shallow, civilization shallow, but they have a trapping mechanism of some sort, and it's a sandstone reservoir you can use the gas out of. There's also the potential for the coal seams themselves in the area to be the gas source. So a lot of depends on the type of production technique. If it falls under COVID methane, it'll be regulated as COVID methane. Conventional gas would largely be looked at as conventional gas. So.
Okay. Senator Seekins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Myers, in the exploration license scenario, as data becomes available, what's the status of that data? Is it public documentation? Is it held sensitive?
Senator Seekins, the chair, drilling well data drilled will be confidential for 25 months from the date of completion, and that's via state statute, AOGCC standards. Seismic data will not become public. So basically, the data acquired falls under the same rules as does well-drilled on conventional lease. If economic incentive credits are used, then there's a requirement to release the data early to us. And eventually, the data, in 10 years, the data becomes public, seismic data becomes public. So if they do use the incentive program, some of them require release of that data beyond the normal terms.
I could, Mr. Chairman. So theoretically, then, as data is obtained by an entity, that entity also allowed then to eventually get involved in the competitive bid process for harvest of what's there?
Senator Seekins, the chair, that's the full intent of the program, that they're allowed to evaluate it, and they in a non-competitive, they negotiate with us, actually, as a term of the license, what the terms would be to convert to a lease.
Okay.
So then they convert typically to a 7-year or a 10-year lease, depending on the area, typically a 12.5% lease. And it won't have to be the entire license area. They can select within that what percentage they want to convert to leases.
So it kind of gives them a leg up. You say, if you guys do this, you're first in line to take the fruit from what you find.
Absolutely. In fact, you're exclusively allowed to do that under the license program.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator Stevens.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You triggered an alarm in my head on the seismic incentive credit. The SB 185 doesn't qualify for this region, does it?
Senator Stevens, the chair, it does.
It does.
The requirements were that it had to be 3 miles from an existing well, a well drilled before 76. So there are areas in here for a well and seismic, basically, because there are no units out here. Basically, it would up to 2007 be allowed the 40% credit.
For the 185.
For the 185.
There was one that we did that didn't. That only went to the North Slope, didn't it?
Actually, that was not restricted to the North Slope. The credits last year, they were statewide. In fact, they applied to private and federal lands as well.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Elton.
Mark, Janet was kind enough to provide a list of the critical habitat areas. How do you deal with those in a lease? Is there an extra public process that goes along with it?
Senator Elton, to the chair,
there's a lot more in the critical habitat. There's a lot more discussion with Fish and Game, for example, on those critical habitat areas. There is, again, a process of elevation should they not like the standards, but there's a lot of information gathering. There's a recognition of the importance of those areas, and so stipulations and mitigation measures are adapted as appropriate to those areas. And so we recognize that that will be a big part of these findings. That's why we're not rushing to the findings either. We're being very careful. Again, also the local community involvement becomes critical. You know, what do they want as well? And what do the folks of the region, the local subsistence users, et cetera, become a big issue in a sale like that? And that's one of the neat things about here, working very closely with the local communities, the local governments, as well as the Native corporations. We should be able to get through those issues. I will say one of the things that's working in our favor is the not siting offshore facilities. That helps a lot, and I suspect we'll have some significant mitigation measures in the critical habitat areas. But it's definitely a key part of the equation. We recognize the wildlife values, and a lot again, the community comments, the organizational comments from the area have been very supportive. But they also acknowledge the balance, the value in those resources.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank the department for providing that information. I've got a copy of it, and I'll make sure that Linda gets a copy too.
Okay, I didn't hear. One of the things that works in your favor is not doing what? I didn't quite hear.
It is the local community involvement out there in helping, you know, in helping us customize the stipulations and mitigation measures because of the amount of sensitive habitat, the amount of anadromous streams, and the caribou populations, et cetera, the marine mammals.
Yeah, yeah, that's a question that I. Leads me up into a question that I had. Memory serves me, I was kind of a young man in the state when if memory serves me, they had a moratorium on leasing. Wasn't it Hammond, maybe, that was governor at the time? And they shut down, they said, you know, it's not compatible with fish, and because obviously the backbone of the economy in Bristol Bay was fishing. That's become less of a backbone. Is that the motivation for the change of attitude about the potential for oil and gas development in the area?
Senator Ogun, I believe so. Many of the letters of support of the process or the memorandums of understanding recognize the economic situation the folks find themselves in there. So I think there's a recognition they need a long-term fix to the economy, the importance of both local energy and potential tax base from oil and gas development. Even in the fishing industry, there's recognized that the value-added part of the industry depends largely on having energy source in order to be able to pay for the refrigeration and the processing. So generally, there's been a big change in the economy. They're looking long-term at what their needs are, and I think that's led to the change. The collapse of prices in the fishing industry there has led to a change in the environment. So the process, it's really important to note that this process started locally. The requests came from the local community to the governor and to the division. And that's what we did not want to go into the area with the level of opposition that was there in the late 70s, early 80s. We don't think it would have been feasible or wise.
I spent a good part of the years that I owned an airplane flying at Bristol Bay, Alaska Peninsula region. In fact, my first cross-country solo was to Port Hyden, and it was a little bit of a long solo for a student pilot, but brought back a couple of caribou, but landed on a lot of cinder beds out there and gravel bars, and it's a pretty amazing country. It's one of probably, in my opinion, one of the great wonders of the world as far as the ecology and the wildlife. And I remember just flying over and just seeing caribou on the tundra like ants on an ant farm or something. I mean, they're just, you know, just a mass of moving bodies and amazingly beautiful country. So, and I know the people there are very, you know, their culture obviously is very tied to, you know, the not only the physical need for providing for their families from the bounty of the land, but the spiritual need as well, which is part of what I get out of being in the wilderness. But So I find it interesting that there's a shift in the culture that, because, you know, you go different demographics around the state, and some people, you know, you even mentioned any kind of oil and gas development, and it's you know, screaming and gnashing of teeth, and then, you know, that, I assume that's the way it was in Bristol Bay, and now it's changed because of the economics, but I do have some concerns. I mean, it's one of probably God's most beautiful places on earth, and, you know, certainly a sportsman's paradise. I mean, it's just beyond description, and so we're going to be able to, I mean, and, you know, deep hole oil and gas obviously has, you know, high pressure oil and gas has more risks associated with it than shallow. I mean, the biggest problem with shallow gas is obviously water disposal, and if you inject the water, then pretty, it's really fairly benign. But, you know, you don't have, but there's potential for oil blowouts, and there's a lot of, there's, I probably shouldn't say this because not many people know it, but there's steelhead down on the southern Alaska Peninsula. I mean, there's some incredible steelhead runs, and there's some just wonderful places. So, I guess mitigation measures, I suppose. And how do we do it right to make sure that if there is a problem, that it's at least mitigated or under control, or mitigation measures to put in place to avoid really permanently damaging the place if there's a problem?
Mr. Chairman, one of the things I didn't mention, I think one of the reasons the potential for oil and gas sale is more appealing to the folks now is the change in technology. Versus, if you look at the wells, the way the earlier wells were drilled there, the environmental safety records improved dramatically. The technology has improved dramatically. The footprint of the development facilities is way smaller, you know, less than probably 20% of the size it would have been it back if it would have been developed in the 1970s and 80s. So when you look at the combination of the tools available, the superior technology now, good stipulations, mitigation measures, setbacks, spill equipment that's going to be needed out there, hopefully a strong locally trained workforce, good spill response. The process designed in large part in cooperation with the folks out there so that we really do put in the right setbacks. Directional drilling rather than offshore siting of facilities, and you combine all it together, and I think you can come up with a darn good case to minimize the environmental effect. Now, you can't take it down to zero, but you can make it approaching zero in terms of the risk. I think one of the key issues will come to truly, if you do find commercial quantities of oil, and that's an if, you know, you do, where do you site a port or a tanker facility? That becomes a major issue. You know, would you even want to put it in the bay, or would you require it to be on the south side? So there are lots of major issues that step by step need to be looked at. And certainly folks have to come into the area carefully, and we have to craft our stipulations and mitigation measures to protect the areas you're talking about. And I think the local folks should and will demand it of us. So the other thing to say is the best interest finding doesn't assume there's going to be a sale. It is a balancing test. Folks will have to, we'll have to demonstrate, and the document, and the state will have to be convinced that it is in the best interest, that the benefit outweighs the risks you're talking about or the effects on the environment.
Is this not the largest contiguous area available for oil and gas leasing onshore in a long, long time? In the United States for sure, and how about the world?
Mr. Chairman, we have over 5 million acres all sold of state lands. If you look at the basin, it's 500 miles long. I don't know of any other place in onshore North America like this other than Anwar Coastal Plain. So it's exciting. I won't say it's the next Anwar because I believe a Cook Inlet type analog is the next best, but I don't know of any place onshore that is potentially open for oil and gas left in North America that would compete with this. Again, we have to qualify it that you've got good oil and gas shows, you know oil and gas was generated in the basin, you have reservoir rocks and you have traps, but we haven't demonstrated commercial hydrocarbons yet. would love to see some modern data. It would help us much better quantify the quality of the resource out there. The seismic data is very old. It's relatively poor quality. The well data is rather old as well. I mean, we have, so truly you need to assess it. You need to have that first layer of exploration. You need some modern seismic, and ultimately you need some holes with some modern equipment. And you need to evaluate gas as well as oil. Gas can't be seen as a throwaway in this case.
I noticed that Representative Moses has joined us. He's welcome to join us up here if you wish, but whatever you're comfortable doing. So, are the targets mostly offshore, the oil that's offshore, but you're going to be drilling from onshore?
Mr. Chairman, if I could point back to this geologic map, and here's a geologic cross-section kind of through the area. I apologize for the audience can't see it. But basically, if you run along the wells right along the shoreline here, you'll see the geology onshore.
Mr. Myers, maybe you could switch sides so the people on the camera can see it at least. There you go.
So I can do the TV weather.
Yeah.
You see the basin is very thick on the onshore. This cross-section comes from basically right along the shoreline here along the coast. And if you look here, then this represents the subsurface potential. So onshore, you'll see a pretty thick section. The thickest section is offshore, but still it's over 15,000 feet, close to 20,000 feet of geologic perspective section onshore. And then it thins to the north. It also thins as you get onto the volcanic arc here. This is the volcanoes. And so this is non-productive. The state is selected very wisely in terms of oil and gas potential here. Federal folks have the volcanoes and those deep terrain, and we have the sedimentary section that's shaped off. So you have what's called a truncation plate, and this is the north. It's basically this concept where it onlaps onto this volcanic panic structure, which creates geologic structures which could be significant for trapping oil and gas.
Is there any potential for hydrates down there?
Mr. Chairman, not that we know of. No, I don't think so. Offshore in the deep water, offshore probably, but certainly onshore, none that we're aware of. Certainly a lot of conventional gas.
Person that finds hydrates near a volcano, a thermal heat source might be able to tap that natural heat to thaw the hydrates.
Sure, there certainly is geothermal potential out in the area, too.
Yeah.
The volcano. Generally, where you have a lot of geothermal activity, it's not a good thing for oil and gas because the reservoir rock isn't low quality. It's too hot.
Yeah. Although it cooks the coal and makes that coal mature for coal bed methane. Because we got geologically young coal in the state, it's not as, at least the shallow stuff isn't as, in some areas that have been explored, isn't as prospective as, because it's not quite old enough, but if it's cooked by the thermal stuff, it's a little bit better potential. Anyway, while we're having too much fun here, we probably ought to get on with the people that are patiently waiting to testify. Does anybody else have any questions? Hearing none. We've got a gentleman in the committee itself, Tom Hawkins. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Hawkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tom Hawkins. I'm the Senior Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of the Bristol Bay Native Corporation. And Bristol Bay has about 7,000 shareholders. Maybe 4,000 of them live in the region, 3,500 to 4,000 of them. About a year ago, my board of directors adopted a resolution encouraging the governor and the Department of Natural Resources to consider oil and gas leasing in Bristol Bay. We found the governor and the department to be very responsive. They've started a process. They've held a lot of hearings. They've been easy to work with. We provided data from our lands to them to make available to attract interest, and we just want the record to reflect that there's good local support for these activities to happen. So we would be in favor of both bills 265 and 266 that address oil and gas leasing and the necessary steps in Bristol Bay.
Great. Now, are you still over on Cordova Street?
Yes, sir.
I built all the cabinet work in your office.
And the cabinets are still working.
Holding up, huh? Good, yes, sir. Good. Yeah, Mr. Dick was in your position at the time, Noble. Yeah, that was gosh 15 years ago, probably. I don't know. It's been a while. So, you know, we've had, you know, I want to make sure that, you know, you're convinced that people in your area, you testified that, but we don't want any unintended consequences and, oh, gee, we didn't hear about it, or, I mean, has there been adequate public notice? I mean, do you think your position represents, have you talked to your members in your corporation and gone out to the villages? And
yeah, actually, I believe that the Bristol Bay Board of Directors is maybe a little more bullish than the general population. But we traveled around the region. We talked to the nonprofits. We talked to the boroughs. We talked to the village corporations. And we found an amazing level of support for oil and gas exploration. The support thinned a bit as we talked about the federal Outer Continental Shelf, the sale 92 that was held out there and later canceled. People are still a little wary of activity out in the bay. But DNR has been very open about explaining access to offshore acreage from onshore, and that's been routinely supported by the various entities and groups that we've conversed with. So I think we've furnished a lot of the resolutions to the Department of Natural Resources because we were trying to get them to do this. We think they've done an excellent job of it's a big region and it's got multiple boroughs, and DNR is you can't visit one place and knock off Bristol Bay. You end up going to King Salmon and to Naknek and to down on the Alaska Peninsula to Dillingham. We also have informed our neighbors, the Aleut Corporation, and they too have worked with the Department of Natural Resources. So we think there's pretty good local support for these activities.
Just a word of caution, I felt pretty strongly about an activity in the area I lived in that it was very supported. And then there's people that have outside agendas from outside that might, I mean, what if Greenpeace shows up in their ship and, you know, goes on shore and, you know, I mean, I guess what I'm trying to say is you can't emphasize enough, I can't emphasize enough to make sure that people understand what the facts are, because, I mean, you know, there's major issues with water disposal, produced water, and, you know, things. And it's a new thing, and it's hard to understand it being done right, and you know the mitigation measures that the DNR and the OGCC puts in and things like that. So
it's a pretty habitat sensitive region.
Oh yeah,
people are pretty shrewd about protecting the values that you earlier talked about. Fish and wildlife and waterfowl, and those values play a very big part of the economy of the region, both the traditional economy of the region and the tourism economy of the region. And people will hold DNR to a high standard.
Yeah.
And make sure that this development is done in a way that allows us to benefit from all these resources.
Yeah, I spent literally hundreds of hours in the air down in that part of the world, my little Satabria. So it's, yeah, it's a jewel. So, okay, well, does anybody have any questions of Mr. Hawkins, Senator Dyson?
Say thanks. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, we have a few other people signed up to testify. Terry Hopperl, did I pronounce that right, Terry?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Good afternoon, Senators. My name is Terry Hefferly. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Bristol Bay Native Association. BBNA is a tribal organization, and 32 of its 38-member board are presidents of the local tribal councils in Bristol, Maine. And the association has gone on record in supporting the hydrocarbon licensing and leasing programs that are for you in Senate Bill 265 and 266. You're right, Mr. Chairman, that back in the early 90s, Bristol Bay unanimously, I believe, opposed lease sale 92. But that was back in the days when the price of a barrel of oil was around $13, and the price of a sockeye salmon was about $12. Currently, I believe the price of oil is $33, and we're looking at a price for a sockeye salmon perhaps next year of somewhere around $2 a fish. Times have changed, and so have people's attitudes. I think that Mr. Hawkins' observation that the initiative for hydrocarbon exploration originated in Bristol Bay is a very factual observation, and I think that much of this initiative has been led by the Bristol Bay Native Corporation and the people of Bristol Bay. I think that concludes my testimony, Mr. Chairman. I think that much of the information regarding the technology that's available now and the information that's available to us, provisions that exist to protect our resources and our way of life are in place. And I think that it's just it's important that we go on record to indicate that the communities of Bristol Bay are in support of both of these bills.
Great. Thanks, sir. I'm glad to see that they recognize the importance of being able to provide good jobs and a stable economy for their communities. And next we have Bryce Edgman, I'm sorry.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bryce Edgman. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation. We are the TDQ organization out in Bristol Bay. Just very briefly, BBDC would like to go on the record as supporting passage of both bills, Senate Bill 265 and 266.
That was pretty brief. You have anything else to say?
No, I don't. Thanks for the opportunity to make a very brief statement.
Okay. Thanks for making a brief statement. And we have, once again, Nels Anderson available to testify. Welcome, Mr. Anderson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to go back to a couple of comments that you made regarding the shift in attitude of people out here. I'm one of them. I'm a subsistence hunter and fisherman. I've been all my life born and raised over in this country. I was one of those that opposed any oil and gas activity in my region for many, many, many years. But one of the things that has happened out here is that we have a failing fishery in terms of not being able to sell our fish at a price that can make a decent living for our fishermen. As a result of that, our economy is going downhill. And many, many people from our region are moving out of the area. And our good brains, our young kids that we're educating at our universities are not coming back home like we'd like them to, because there aren't any opportunities out here. So we do need to diversify our economy. We really have no choice. And I'm one of those who is very, very proud of the Bristol Bay Native Corporation. I think they took a very, very courageous step and shifted, made a huge step in shifting our thinking away from being totally dependent on commercial fishing as our sole source of economic activity. And I commend them for doing that, and I also commend them for working very, very closely with the Murkowski administration. The governor has visited with the leaders of our region and has made it very, very clear that he would not have started this initiative on his part from the state's point of view without full support of the region. Several things have happened. One of those I mentioned is that we have a failing fishery out here. Our fish are not being sold for the prices we'd like. We hope to turn that around at some point in time, but we can't do it without low-cost energy. And hopefully, oil and gas exploration will lead us to low-cost energy at some point in the future. Another thing that's happened that's convinced me to change my mind about oil and gas activity in my region is that I'm more confident in the ability of the oil and gas industry to do their exploration work without serious harm to the environment. We've been very, very successful as Native people out here protecting our fish and game resources. Our regional organizations are vigilant in that respect, and the Native people in our villages always make sure that our leaders know if there's something going wrong, and we do everything we can do possible to prevent any harm to our fish and game. I suspect that that vigilance will continue even as we move ahead aggressively with oil and gas development on the Alaska Peninsula. There are several concerns that I have, but I also want to just wrap up and say a couple of things. I support the passage of Senate Bill 265 and Senate Bill 266. I think they will help to expedite and move the calendar a bit in our favor so that leasing can and licensing can occur a little bit earlier than is currently the case under current law. So we'd urge you to pass these as quickly as possible so that the administration can move ahead aggressively to find out and find as many interested people in our oil and gas potential as possible. The only concern I have is that there is no real official oversight capability on what's happening in the region. I think that the Murkowski administration and our regional leaders need to think about that. And the only way that I can think of that would provide the necessary oversight to make sure that our fish and game resources are protected adequately would be the formation of a borough that encompassed the entire region. But that's something that we'd have to work out here on the local level. And then another thing that we'd have to do, I believe, to help not only the mining industry, I mean the oil and gas industry, but the mining industry with that huge pebble find up in the Iliamna area, is that they really can't build roads and they really can't develop the energy without the full cooperation of all the villages of the Bristol Bay region. So I have asked the administration to take a very serious look at a Bristol Bay Regional Development Authority, not unlike the Kenai Bridge authority that will help expedite the construction of that particular facility. So the two things I need, I think that the region needs is that we may have to have a bureau to provide that oversight to protect our fishing game resources, and two, a Bristol Bay Regional Development Authority under the state of Alaska to help the construction of the infrastructure that will provide the access and provide the power needed to develop our oil and gas industry and our mineral industry out here. And Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for allowing me to take this time with you.
Thank you again for your involvement in the process this year. It's great to have folks in Bristol Bay weighing in and testifying in our committee. And at least if you form a borough, if this development is successful, you have a tax base that you can pay for it with, and maybe pay for some of your help support better education and a lot of other, as well as provide good jobs. So there's a lot of pluses to bringing this kind of development into your community. Let's see. Do we have anybody else on the teleconference network that may wish to testify that hasn't signed up? And do we have anybody else in the audience that has liked to testify that hasn't done so?
Mr. Chairman, we have Gilmer Olson signed up to testify.
Okay. All right. I'm sorry. I have a couple of different sheets here. And okay, go ahead, Mr. Olson.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Gilmer Olson. Like Senator Anderson here, I'm born and raised in the region here all my life and fished over 50 years. And I've been on the board of directors of Bristol Bay Native Corporation now for 30 years. I've been chairman and president now for 25 years. And we've seen the changes in the economy out here with the low value of our fishery. And about a year ago, the BB&C board took a giant step in saying, let's take another look at our lands for oil and gas. And I want to applaud the governor, congratulate him on trying to develop our natural resources out here and looking at our economy here. But anyway, we've had several meetings. I've heard you talk about are the shareholders approving of this. We've had not many meetings, but at least a dozen around the region. And the first thing we say, we got to cooperate and move forward on this to take advantage of oil and gas if there is going to be some found, and get some good jobs out here. The cost of living is very high, and no longer can one make a decent living out of the salmon fishery here. So I agree with what everyone else said. And support SB 265 and SB 266. And if there's any questions, I'll be glad to answer. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Does anybody have any questions? Hearing none. Is there anybody else that hasn't had the opportunity to testify that would like to? Okay. Also, Marie Crosley, I noticed, is on the online to answer questions. She's with DNR if anybody has any questions. We have the director here, too, so. Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. What's the lady's name?
Marie Crosley.
Yeah, Marie is Dyson. I know that there are some very significant cultural resources in the area. A number of the villages that have been investigated by archaeology teams over the years. Can you tell us what protections we will have to make sure that those are not disturbed, or if they are, that there's a sufficient analysis before that happens?
Senator Dyson, through the chair, I believe that both federal and state law are quite protective of the archaeological resources. We also have I believe, three mitigation measures that are attached to the lease that would also protect them. And then prior to a permit being issued, the lessee would investigate known sites so that they would know those locations and could steer clear of them.
Thank you.
Yeah, Senator Dyson, my experience in the private sector, there's a requirement in the mitigation measures that archaeologists go out and survey the sites wherever there's work done for any potential archaeological finds, and if there is any, then they have to be discovered, or either mitigation measures in to not disturb them, or if they're going to be disturbed, they have to be done right and cataloged, and maybe, you know, so we don't lose that forever. So, and yeah, it's a rich area for, you know, the culture's been there for thousands of years. I'm sure there's some of those areas. Yeah, Senator Elton.
Just kind of a procedural question, Mr. Chair. I had assumed we'd started out on SB 266. And I don't know what bill we're on.
We're still on 266.
Okay. And then the director will be coming back up for 265.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Although most of the people who testified, I think, testified in favor of both of them, and I'm going to, unless they want to testify additionally on 265, we'll assume that they were in favor of both. So, having no other, nobody else has any questions, you know, I have just a little bit of a check of passing this out today. However, I'll defer to the will of the committee. I think I'd like to make sure that we don't get people showing up going, gee, I didn't know about it, I didn't hear about it, I didn't get my chance to say something. But if the committee feels that there's adequate support out there in the communities and been adequately represented and testified on, we'll accept the motion.
Well, Mr. Chair, just a suggestion for your consideration. I mean, I see the bills as a pair, and maybe a motion for both of them after we've heard 265, because one kind of relates to the other, and it may be a good idea to just move them after we've talked about 265 also.
My staff just informed me this is the second committee. I assume it had a committee in regional affairs referral before this. Okay, so there was no opposition.
Heard this Monday. There was some opposition, Mr. Chairman. The only opposition was the fact that the administration had not supplied us with the letters of support from the Native associations and corporations, et cetera. And the packet's pretty full of that now, and it's pretty overwhelming, so I don't think there would be any opposition at that level.
Thank you, Senator Wagner. Okay, well, why don't we hear 265 now, and Mr. Myers, you want to give us an overview on that one? We'll set aside 266 for now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Basically, 265 is fairly straightforward. The area-wide leasing statutes require we notify the legislature at the first part of a session of changes to the area-wide lease sale process. Procedurally, we're requesting to have that change to just a notification of the legislature of those changes. Originally, it's a requirement that went back to pre-area-wide leasing, where the state would propose the only mechanism of leasing instead of licensing and chattel gas was strictly the competitive lease sale process. There were competitive sales proposed all over the state, down in the Yakutat area, up in Icy Bay, Icy Cape, various parts of the North Slope. The North Slope sales weren't area-wide, they were segmented. So the lease sale schedule was constantly changing. And under that scenario, then, the legislature had a five-year schedule of all these different sales, and we would notify in the first part of the session of changes to that sale. Under area-wide, it's a little different. We traditionally have offered the same areas every year, so there's a more predictable pattern. to it. So this is, again, the first time other than North Slope Foothills in recent history where we've added another another sale to the area-wide process. Because of the timing of the sale, because of the the sale, again, really being supported and driven by the local folks coming to us, under the current law, the earliest we could offer this sale would be 2007, because under the current law, we have to notify you next year and then give you a two-year notice. So the request and change of law is to be able to notify the legislature any time. The legislature doesn't vote on it. It's just a notification procedure. So the law, the changes requested allow the flexibility to have this particular sale happen in 2005 versus 2007.
Mr. Myers, this would affect all the sales in the state, although you need it for this particular one to... this one on in the Hopper Center. Do you think this is a good thing for sales, and cocaine lit and other things? I mean, I think maybe your testimony was that those are predictable anyway, because you've got those areas identified, so it's like no surprises. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I think the other thing is there's been some perfection of the best interest finding process. So it's these sales, again, through that process, it's typically an 18-month plus process to go through. The sales don't sneak up on anyone. There's lots of public input. There's lots of notification. And again, I guess if the legislature, I guess notifying the legislature, I'm not sure, I wouldn't call it a courtesy, but it doesn't require, the statutory language doesn't require you to vote. It's just a notification that we're proposing this. The fact that the process itself lasts up to 2 years for a new best interest finding, I think does give a lot of public notification, does, give the legislature notice if we give them notice any time. On the other hand, I guess I'm not really sure of the original intent of the first part of the session. I'm not sure why that really was in the old program as well. I do know that we did have lots of various sales in different areas with lots of different sensitivities involving with them, and I don't anticipate, a half dozen other area-wide sale areas being proposed. So I don't know if I'm answering your question very well, but it just seems that realistically there won't be many examples of this, of us going forward with additional area-wide sales in the next 2 years. I mean, our plate's pretty full with this. Maybe I can, historically, Marie may know more of the justification, so I could ask her to comment.
If I might comment on one of the things you said first, the legislative intent of why the first part of the session, I might suggest that it's because by the end of the session we're so busy we wouldn't necessarily notice that you noticed us because of the distractions and the fact that you got budgets and all these bills piling up and there's not enough time to sometimes to be fully briefed on everything that's before you. So I know you're attempting to strike that language from the. Is there a reason why you need that language out of there? I mean, this says between the first and the 15th day. I mean, I suspect, like I said, it's because we have more time to pay attention to those types of notices then than we do at the end of session. I guess technically you could give it to us the last day of session when everybody's focused on just, cutting the deal to get out of Dodge and get out of town. So is that on that point?
That was the point I was going to make. I mean, I'd go even further. I mean, I recognize that what we have now can be cumbersome, and I certainly recognize the problems that occur when we apply them specifically. But I too am, I mean, this is pretty loosey-goosey. I mean, the way I read it, it's not even a requirement that they present their annual report on the last day of the session. They can present it in August. I mean, I don't see anything here that says by a date specific, and the concern that I have is that in fixing a problem, I mean, we're doing it in such a way that I'm somewhat concerned that the legislature loses some of its prerogatives. And I like the requirement that we be notified at the beginning of a session, because it allows us to put in perspective, whether it's in the Senate Resources or Resources Committee in the other body, or special oil and gas committees, it allows that to be part of the pipeline of information that we make decisions upon. I also recognize there is no requirement for a vote. So I guess I appreciate your comments, Mr. Chair, and I'd go even further that I'm not sure we want to make it quite this loosey-goosey.
You know, does, on that point, it does say notify the legislature, and that could be, you know, you send it to one aide, you know, in somebody's office. I mean, what kind of modality is that encompass, Mr. Director?
Mr. Chairman, I believe the language is the same, the notification procedure is the same. It's just the timing we're attempting to change. So right now, I guess we could send it to the clerk that's behind the third bathroom, but, you know, in reality, of course, that wouldn't happen. So again, I don't think there's any desire to change the intent of the legislature being included in the loop. It's merely providing the flexibility to hold the sale as quickly as we reasonably can. And again, we were encouraged by the local input in this case to try to get the sale as quickly and as smoothly, given the concerns and given the best interest finding process, that we do it as quickly as possible. Again, given having a full and complete process. Again, the consequences of the first part of the session, I'm not sure as to why it has to be the first part of a two-year session, for example. That was the old requirement. It couldn't be the first part of this year. It had to be the first part of last year or next year.
Sure, to clarify, I mean, that's exactly right, I think. But if we're going to have an annual report, I'd like to see some discussion of why that annual report isn't due to the legislature by January 15th or something of each year.
And maybe we could, and Senator Stevens had something, but on that point, maybe we could work on the language a little bit and specify who in the legislature. I think I've seen bills where, and notifications where the chairs of certain committees, or, you know, the chair of Ledge Council, because Ledge Council has kind of the oversight of, during the interim, of legislative business, you know, the minority leader, the majority leader, that, you know, we could maybe make it a list so that we could get some comfort that we know it's going directly to their offices or something, and then, you know, if there's some red flags that go up, they have the ability to talk to their members of their committees or their, you know, their caucus. Senator Stevens?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, the language doesn't cause me any angst, because the way I read the language, it says the commissioner shall annually prepare a five-year program of proposed lease sales to be offered for leasing during the calendar year of the notification. So to me, that's the way I read this, is it's due by January 1st. It would be dated January 1st, and the calendar year is that year. Otherwise, it's to the best interest of the commissioner to give it to us on January 1st, because he could give it to us on December 15th, but then he's only making a change for the last 15 days of the year. I mean, I don't see a problem with it. If he's going to propose a change to the five-year annual program, and he's to give it to us annually, it only makes sense that he'll give it to us at the beginning of the year under this. I don't have a problem with the way it's drafted. It just says that, you know, during the year of the notification, and he'll present it annually. So if he wants to give us a program for the annual program within that calendar year, it will be early in the year. I do have one question, though, Mr. Chairman, on page 2. Maybe this is to Mr. Myers, who is a drafter, if you have somebody online. And it's on page 2, line 2, which says, by other means. The sentence reads, notification to each legislature by electronic message or other means. And that constitutes notification to the legislature under this subsection. That, to me, those three words, by other means, are pretty ambiguous. And I would like to have further definition of that one. It'd be via other written means, I would suspect. And I would offer a technical amendment to include that. and ask for unanimous consent on that, Mr. Chairman.
Is that a, that's a motion to add written before means?
Yes.
Is that okay?
We have all.
Okay, well, so there's a motion. Is there objection to that motion? Hearing none, so ordered. Senator Dyson?
Yeah, thank you. Following this discussion with great interest, my guess is that a presentation at the beginning of the session, that this is like several other things where Boundary Commission comes to mind, but if they make a decision, then it happens unless the legislature takes it as my purpose to intervene and stop it. And my guess is that was what was going on there, is to give the legislature a chance to stop an action that they found to be bad public policy or outrageous. So my guess is that we ought to follow the suggestions here to make sure that all the legislators and particularly the relevant committees get the notification. And indeed, if we find that it is an outrageous action on the part of the administration, we can either deal with it in ledge council or call ourselves into special session. I appreciate both these bills going forward, and I don't anticipate that ever happening. But who knows what band of thieves might be sitting in all of our seats and sometime in the future that aren't being responsible and paying attention.
Well, I need to correct myself here. Looking on the bill a little bit further, it does say notification to each legislator. So each legislator would assume get it. So I don't think we need to specify various chairmen and that type of thing. It seems like everybody would get it. Is that correct, Mr. Myers?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. And maybe if I could have Marie Crosley discuss this a little bit. She's real familiar with the history. Maria, you online?
Before she gets on, I think on that point, Senator Elton.
Well, I just want to follow up, and I certainly don't want to suggest this would ever happen in this administration, but who knows about other administrations? I mean, I think Senator Stevens may be seeing something in here that I'm not seeing, but I don't see anything in here that precludes an annual report from being issued in January of one year, and in August of another year. And the concern that I have is that if it's presented in August the next year, it may be because somebody says, you know, let's wait until the legislature goes home. You know, we don't want to answer any questions. We don't want to, you know, I don't see anything that precludes that kind of behavior. I mean, there may be an assumption that because they do a report on that calendar year, that they do it in a timely manner. But we have removed the language that provides that they will do it in a timely manner.
On that point, Mr. Myers, in this particular reason we're here discussing this is because of the Bristol Bay sale. Let's assume that we say, okay, we've already cut you some slack, and instead of a biannual report, we're doing it annually. And you are required to do an annual report at the beginning of the legislature next year. How would it affect the sale? And your, I assume it would affect your, Gantt chart there?
Mr. Chairman, again, it has to be on the schedule, I believe, for 2 years. So if we notified you next year at the beginning of the session, the earliest the sale could go off is in 2007. So it would fully shift it to 2 years. And I'd have to think about now exactly how the notification now, since the bill isn't law yet, if we went to the first 15 days of the session having to notify you now, I assume it would be next year as well, in 2 years. So I think the effect of changing the legislation until the bill passes, if we passed it with the restrictive January time frame, would delay the sale for 2 years. And maybe Marie or Pirtle sees it differently, but that's how I would read it.
Maybe we could do it for this, to modify the bill a little bit to do it for this sale, because I mean, we're notified, you're here, you know, we know it's going to happen. It's been publicly discussed and a good public process on it. And then make the rest of them chances are if this happens, if nobody picks it up, it'll be into an area-wide sale every year. If somebody picks up part of it or not all of it or whatever. And so then it's not a problem. But basically, we're doing this for this project, correct, for this particular sale?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. And then also to provide future flexibility. But the driver is this sale again. We don't know of any other proposed area-wide sales.
All right.
Chair, on that point, I don't think that's a problem because, I mean, we have two elements in Section B. The first element is when they report, but it also provides, beginning on line 13 on page 1, that the commissioner may at any time notify the legislature of revisions. So I don't think there would be, with that provision, I don't think there is a problem that would force the department to, I mean, we have an immediate effective date. So I don't think there's a problem that would affect this sale because, quite frankly, they can revise.
Mr. Chairman, if I could again refer to our folks there, I think they can clarify if I misspoke. Marie, Carol.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Marie, did you have something?
No, I think Mark is correct. I think there's two elements to this. First of all is the when we add a sale to the schedule, we would notify the legislature immediately upon that time. And then the second part is the production of a five-year program, which we're...
You're kind of cutting out. The second is what?
Production of a five-year program and notifying the legislature of its availability, and we're proposing to change that to an annual...
I think you might have to move closer to the microphone. You're cutting out.
Okay, I'm right on top of it.
Okay, sorry.
The second part of it would be notifying the legislature of availability of a five-year program each year instead of every other year.
Okay. Senator Stevens?
Well, I appreciate Marie clarifying that because that's exactly what I was going to point out is that this makes it goes from a two-year to a one-year requirement for them to report to the legislature, but it also allows, and it's a five-year plan, and they're supposed to report to us on the activities of that calendar year plus their proposed for the following 4 years. But it also gives latitude to the commissioner to say, at any time during that plan, we can change the plan under notification. So the commissioner could say, well, we want to change our lease from 07 to 06. And we can send that in November. Or they can say, we're going to change the lease sale from September to December in a year. But I think we're getting stuck up here in a little bit on some technicalities. But in my mind, it gives some latitude to the commissioner, but it also gives us a greater reporting mechanism because they have to notify us of a change every year instead of not only every year, but every time they make a proposed change. And they're supposed to come in annually instead of biannually. So I think that it cleans it up even better. The more we understand it, the more sense it makes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. But you have some strong feelings on it. Anybody else? Is there anybody that would like to testify to this that maybe some issues were brought up during discussion that would like to briefly say something? It's getting close to 5 o'clock. Anybody on the network that would like to comment additionally? Hearing none, I'd entertain a motion to move out 266. That's the first one.
265. Do them both at once.
Well, I think we need separate motions.
Okay. I'd move Senate Bill 266 with individual recommendations and an official one.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. I need to put on the record that I have run research vessels in this very area related to this basin in years past. And nobody owes me any money from those, but they were oceanography projects and marine biology related to the environmental impact statement. And I worked there, and then I fished there for 25 years. I don't think I have any financial interest there. I don't think I owe anybody money or anybody owes me money. But but clearly I've spent a good part of my adult life working in the area. And
well, you're ultimately qualified to participate and discuss in this because of your knowledge. Thank you. And given your breadth of experience down there, do you have any, what are you're ready to vote on this and move this out and think it's a good thing?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I think that's a good thing. Okay. Anybody else? So, is there objection to the bill moving from committee? There's a motion to move 266. No objection. Bill's moved. Mr. Vice Chairman.
I'd move Senate Bill number 265 also with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
I object. Mr. Chair,
this objection.
For the purposes of a potential amendment and maybe Senator Stevens will give me leave to scratch an itch here. I think that we ought to consider amending this bill so that the commissioner shall, on line six, the commissioner shall annually prepare and prior to February 1st of each calendar year notify the legislature of. And the reason I'm doing this and the reason I'm being somewhat persistent here is, I mean, I think there is value for the legislature in session to have before it the five-year plan. I think it enables legislators in the course of their business to know what the department projects as a reasonable schedule out over 5 years. And I don't want to get into a situation in which we get the five-year plan when everybody's gone and there's no opportunity to comment on it or to work with the department to try and understand why lease sale X is in year four and lease sale Y is in year three. I think if we don't provide a deadline for that five-year schedule, I mean, we're precluding the opportunity for the legislature to discuss it if, in fact, they want to do that in session.
Well, there's a motion on the table to move the bill, so the amendment would be out of order. However, if you want to offer an amendment, I'll ask the Vice Chairman to withdraw the motion.
All right. Mr. Chair, I would offer an amendment, page one, line six, to add the language after the and on line five, prior to February 1st of each calendar year, and then pick up again on line seven, notify the legislature of.
Prior to February 15th of each calendar year?
February 1st.
February 1st, okay. Mr. Myers?
Yes, I am.
Those are out of order in this committee.
Okay.
Let's have a brief of these. Mr. Meyer?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Tell the boss to call you when you're not on the committee. Heard an answer. Let's see. What are your feelings about the proposed amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I personally, as long as it doesn't delay this particular sale, and I have to make sure of that, I believe it doesn't, but I'm not 100% sure, I wouldn't have any objection to it. Marique, did you see any? Excuse me.
Sure.
Marie, do you see any potential delay of the Bristol Bay sale based on
Crosley?
Mr. Chairman, no, I don't believe so.
Okay, we would
We would not object.
Do you want to think about it, and we can bring this bill up next week and move it out as amended, or make sure that there aren't any unintended consequences with amendments, which sometimes there is? Are you sure, Marie?
Yes, I'm reasonably sure. I think one of the problems was in Section 2, where we had we were required to have a sale on the schedule for a minimum of 2 years.
Senator Elson?
Mr. Chair, I would want to reassure the department and the committee that if, in fact, this did cause problems for the sale that we have been talking about in 266, I mean, even though it's my amendment, I would encourage that we revisit it and the rules are on the floor. But I don't see that as being a problem.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, we'd be comfortable with the amendment.
All right. You're all comfortable with the amendment. Is there objection to the amendment?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stevens.
My friend from Juneau, I just don't understand why the time sensitive. I mean, the bill makes it annual requirement for reporting. Whereas the other one was biannual. I still don't see a reason to put the time sensitive, make it so that they annually have to report that, make that report by a certain time. Maybe I have a higher level of confidence in the fact that these programs are being revised and they're going to be presented anyway, and that we normally, this committee has Mr. Meyer or his future occupant of that important role here every legislature anyway. So I don't know.
I assume it would be a no vote.
I'll go with individual recommendations, I guess, but I'm not going to support the amendment.
Mr. Chair, just in response, I understand that. I certainly don't think that Mr. Myers' intent is to keep information from the legislature, but if, in fact, the annual report is delivered every October, it essentially means that the next legislature, when we get together, we're going to be reviewing essentially 4 years instead of 5 years. I guess what I want is I want the opportunity for the legislature to have the opportunity to look at a five-year schedule, because if they do their annual report in October or November, the next legislature is going to be looking at their four-year plan.
Well, I see some of my friends feel one way and some of my other friends feel another way, and I agree with my friends. So I guess we'll, you're both making sense. I look at that time of the year, I'm pretty busy. My able-bodied staff is keeping me informed of what's going on, but I have private sector interests that I do, my focus is sometimes elsewhere. So I can see some value to having it during session when we're paying attention. I guess we have a motion before us. We'll call for the question. The clerk, take the roll.
Senator Stevens?
No.
Senator Dyson?
Yes.
Senator Stevens?
No.
Senator Wagner?
Yes.
Senator Elton?
Yes.
Mr. Elton? I'll vote yes, because I like to be on the winning side.
You could have gone either way.
I could have gone either way.
Mr. Chair, I don't look at this as a winner.
No, actually, I know. I think it's good. I'm voting yes because I think it's probably good public policy. I could have voted no, and it would have been a tie vote. So I'll break the tie. The amendment is passed. The public process works in this committee, and thank you for bringing that to our attention. So, would the vice chairman, is there any other issues or amendments or anything? Hearing none, the vice chairman make a motion to move the bill.
Move for approval of Senate Bill 265 as amended with individual recommendations from fiscal officer.
Okay, and as amended, correct?
Yeah.
Bill as amended, zero fiscal notes. Is there objection to the bill moving from committee? Hearing none. She's out of here at 5 o'clock straight up, right on schedule. And
oh, you're 8 seconds.
I look at this as an hour into the Carlos Boozer NBA game.
With that, we will adjourn.